Well, good evening. For ex-CSU alumni who haven't visited Fort Collins in the last 5 or 7 years, here's the new front to our old hospital that's now 25 years old. Unfortunately, when you go through these doors, it's still the same side. But it looks nice now on the outside rather than a concrete bunker from the Cold War. Okay, so I'm going to begin with this first case that actually was only about a month ago that visited us and we worked up. So we've got an elderly lab retriever who I guess didn't move fast enough because the owner backed over it with his backhoe. And then the dog couldn't really walk on its hind legs. So it came to us, and you can read the physical exam, alert, but increased respiratory effort and rate and decreased lung sounds, crepitus in the left hip. So it was stabilized with the CCU group and pain relief given and some preliminary blood work and the like done, with then plans to evaluate this pelvic region, and the radiographs of the pelvis revealed a fracture of the left acetabulum, which is really not of interest at this point to us. But the respiratory signs were of concern prior to the need to do plating surgery on the fracture. So what I have here then is the survey radiographs made of the dog.
Can you drop the mic a little bit?
Yeah, I think.
How do you do that?
It's actually on. You have to get a lot closer. So, here's the right recumbent lateral first. So, we'd like you to form your opinion about that. One of the disadvantages I find about this electronic medium we're now in, you really only can show sort of one film at a time. Where in the old days you could have like two projectors and show the ventral dorsal simultaneously. So now I'm going to go to the opposite lateral, left recumbent lateral. It's quite common in our radiology practice to actually perform both a left and a right recumbent lateral radiograph routinely for metastasis evaluation, but also for complicated thoracic radiographs. So, things aren't normal, eh? Okay, well, I think you should have the ventral dorsal view before we go finally with this. Well, that was a bit of a surprise based on the almost normal appearance of the right recumbent lateral view. That one's interesting to me. And then our ventral dorsal view. Okay, so who would like to input some observations then? Pardon? Leafing of the lungs, very good, yes. It's asymmetrical, I think, compared to the right side. It shows some collapse of lungs and pool fluid coming in between them, with probably a great degree of atelectasis of the lungs. Who's that? So rib fractures? Yeah, certainly I can't see that one clearly. What about a diaphragm? So it comes up here and then it vanishes, so we call this a silhouette sign, silhouetting, with likelihood explained by this being the leafing and the density change being due to fluid, right? Pleural fluid. And knowing the history, we'd think bleeding. And some likely contusions underneath it. What about the diaphragm on this side? Weird. Okay. But is that back to the laterals? See, this is the right lateral, so the right crust will be left lateral. I mean, this is the left crust forward, right crust backwards, coming down, I can see to about this point here, but then I can't see the cupula of the diaphragm on our view here. If I go back to the previous one, I have the same impression. In this region here, I can't see a distinct cupula border. What I'm interested in is the radio opacity of the area where the diaphragm seems to be missing. What would be the first organ we would think that could go through there when we don't find gas-filled loops in the bowel? Liver. We see stomach actually behind some liver, but is this right for liver density? No, it's not white enough, isn't it? Not radio opaque enough. It's too lucid. And the same over here. It's a much less radio opacity than the fluid in the heart and the fluid over here. But I would still be really concerned about that diaphragm. Agreed? Okay. So, congratulations, good work. We've got pleural effusion, likely hemorrhage from the trauma. We have this mass effect here, but not of a density that we would expect for liver. And we don't see any bowel herniated through there. Distortion of the border along the left diaphragm on the ventrodorsal view. Diaphragmatic hernia, question. We need to be really sure now because this dog's going to have a major surgery. We don't want to do anesthesia on these contused lungs. If we need to repair a diaphragmatic hernia, we're going to use positive pressure ventilation, all sorts of important decisions. So where could we go? Ultrasound. Good radiology film reading session. That's exactly what the clinician did, turn in a request for an ultrasound exam. We had 14 ultrasound requests standing at that time point. So it was going to be back a little ways behind that. And I've had some experience with these where it's been quite difficult to be really sure in what turns out to be there that it's really there. A liver hernia, absolutely guided by the distortion of blood vessels, guided by distortion of cava and position of liver lobes, yes, I'm quite confident that I can find a diaphragmatic hernia when liver lobes are herniated. But I've had a bad experience before with this situation. So one of the problems that our residents have in passing radiology boards is they say exactly what you just said. Do something fancy. The old radiologists are now one of those old guys. Well, we used to diagnose those things before anyone had ultrasound. A radiologist worth their salt should be able to diagnose it without resorting to other modalities. So anything you can think of? Yes, I think that's a good choice. I'll certainly outline where the GI tract is, though I'm not really impressed on the radiographs that there is any displacement of GI tract. So I'll do something even more simple that I've always helped me over the years back before ultrasound and other imaging modalities, and actually use a horizontal X-ray beam. So this image was positioned with the dog laying on its back as for a ventrodorsal view, but we turned the X-ray beam horizontally and made another lateral. And so that way fluid will gravitate downwards and air will gravitate upwards. And you can sometimes outline the diaphragm much better like that. It depends on your preference how you like to look at these. Actually, this is how it was made. And I usually think this is more useful for me to understand what gravity is doing here. So we see a little stomach gas now with a flat line in it because of a fluid gas line here, being a normal distance from the diaphragm. You still see the crosses of the diaphragm well. If that was significant amounts of fluid making that density, I would expect a lot of fluid density down dorsally now, because it would have all gravitated down here, but there's not. And I can still see nice outlined lobes of lungs here without any mass type lesion. So we're still that was stupid, wasn't it? It didn't take us anywhere. It's ruled out though liver, I think. There's no liver mass forward. Again, do you see this gray density here that's not the same opacity as the liver here? Okay. So carrying along this same vein of thought before ultrasound was available, and also challenging our residents. Think about your board exams. Is there any other radiographic technique that you could do to evaluate the diaphragm integrity? Dye in the abdomen. Very good. Called a positive peritoneogram. Just like you would tap the abdomen, but in reverse, inject 1 mil per pound body weight into the abdomen. And then, because you want to find out where the diaphragm and its integrity is, you want to just wheelbarrow the dog a little bit to gravitate it forward. And I've always found it important to make both left and right recumbent lateral views as well as ventral dorsal views. So that's exactly what we challenged our resident to go and look up in the book, because they'd never done one in their residency so far, for a positive peritoneogram. Here it is in the dog in right lateral recumbency. You can see the contrast in the abdomen, outlining, in this case, the diaphragm coming down here beautifully, with gaps in between the contrast because of the liver lobes in that region. And there's the study. And there's the ACE view. Here now is the left recumbent lateral view. Remember on the ventral dorsal view, that the left diaphragm was the one that had the triangular shaped structure sort of protruding from its surface. So when we follow the left diaphragm down here, still intact at this level here, now we see positive contrast has sneaked through a discontinuity in this area right here and is outlining this bunch of worms. See all these filling defects here? Like a bunch of worms sitting in there, but it's outlining. So, now we've clinched the diagnosis of diaphragmatic hernia. We can actually tell the surgeon where it is. It's very, very ventral. Any idea what the material is now, thinking about the survey radiographs and its radio opacity and the fact that this is all sort of worm-like? Excellent. So we told the surgeon what they were going to find in there. Was that the omentum had herniated through a ventral rent in the lower portion of the cupula of the left diaphragm, and that was then the, in part, cause of the respiratory compromise that was present. So they went to abdominal laparotomy. I think it was within 24 hours of this, and that's exactly what they found, was that there was a only small, couple of centimeter tear in the cupula on the left side of the diaphragm, and the greater omentum had herniated down through it. So in ultrasounding similar cases before, I've had a real tough time sometimes even finding the small rent. And seeing this stuff in the thorax that has a weird sort of echogenicity, doesn't have any blood vessels in it, it doesn't look quite the right stuff for atelectic and consolidated or contused lungs, and has this sort of vague sort of black and white and mottled stuff through there, even to the point of, I don't know what I am looking at, sticking a needle in it to be told I just tapped into fat. So in my experience with these, ultrasound in a smaller rent like this with just the omentum through has been not a definitely conclusive finding. You have to work very hard to image the very ventral diaphragm here to find the hole. It's not like looking at the regular diaphragm where we look much lower down. This is right under the sternum here. And so here's an old-fashioned series of techniques that I used to do before ultrasound, because I started in 1976 with just an X-ray machine in practice. These techniques then sometimes can help you work out what's going on. Questions, comments? On the leakage, it wasn't convincing. One of the problems with this technique is if you have a lot of pleural effusion, the contrast diffuses into the pleural effusion. This was the one view that you could call it 100% on. Yes? Mm-hmm. You're right. Well, I believe, let's jump way back to there. This one here. This density that's here, I believe, is fat density up all the way around here, making a partial silhouetting of with the heart. And so the heart's been displaced, and there's these blobs of more fat density here, and displacing lungs in this area here, and also more fat density down here, causing both the shift of the lungs and the heart from the omentum being in the space occupying mass. But not being of the right density to say it was liver herniation. Okay, so I hope that was of interest to you. I've got to step through these again, I'm sorry, they pop up here. So, the surgery was done to perform the diaphragmatic hernia and the omentum repaired. During that time, the dog developed some heart arrhythmia abnormalities, and so it actually took a couple more days of rest in confinement and support in critical care before they were did the pelvic surgery to plate the fracture, which the author had handled. Okay, my next thoracic case. German Shepherd, 3 years old, name's Wolf. Laboured breathing initially and went to the referring veterinarian. We never saw these thoracic radiographs, but pleural effusion was diagnosed, a chest tube was placed, some antibiotics and Rimadyl were given, and the dog was referred for CSH to us for further evaluation. He was quite dyspneic and had decreased lung sounds. Otherwise, everything seemed normal on presentation to us. The chest tube was already in place, and so they aspirated material from that, and it wasn't clear to me in reading the history from the referring veterinarian whether or not they had diagnosed a pyothorax at that point, and that's why antibiotics were given. I suspect that was the case, but it was certainly confirmed by us. And he was admitted to critical care and treated for both pain, the respiratory compromise, and for the pyothorax. 24 hours later, he became painful in his abdomen and hadn't eaten since he'd visited us. And so it was elected at that point to start this time with an ultrasound exam. So I've selected some images here that I regard as important ones to observe changes of lesions on. So I have a sagittal image of the cranial abdomen with liver and stomach being outlined. Then one further to the left with spleen, and this is always a good place under the spleen to look for small bowel. And this is what we were seeing with small bowel. And then another one here where we'd imaged the right kidney and then just moved slightly ventral to that and observed this pattern. And then further, more caudally along that same right side, we recognized some omentum this time with echogenic effusion around it. I typed in free fluid for you because you could see this material swirling, which I don't have any video really to convince you of that, but that was the case. Okay, so let's step back. Any concerns on our cranial image of the liver and stomach? Diaphragm, see the liver border extending caudal to the stomach. Stomach was empty. Dog hadn't eaten. It has a good looking parenchyma. I don't see any focal lesions in it or other changes. Coming caudal to it, I see the stomach here. Is this what you expect to see, stomach? So I could increase bright echoes. Yes, in this area here and over here. I would attribute that to probably gas. It doesn't concern me the gases in the center, but it does concern me that the bright gas things extend out to this level where the border of the stomach looks to be at this location here. And the stomach is fairly small and contracted to me, but I just don't see a nice increased thickness to the normal layering of the gastric wall that I expect to see with a contracted stomach wall. So yes, it's an important observation of the asymmetry of some of the gas patterns there and the wall. Now, how do you like this for small bowel? Funny looking. Good point. Not normal, is it? No, we hadn't done ready gas at this time. Ultrasound was quiet. So they got it processed quickly. Ultrasound's always like 15 patients like yesterday, or 3 patients. There's too many layers there, yes. So this isn't a true long access. I'm not quite sure what my colleague did in terms of the angle. But this pattern is described as corrugation, corrugated type appearance to small bowel. And so, yes, that's one of... It unfortunately isn't pathognomonic for any specific diagnosis. Ischemia can do it. String foreign body can do it. Peritonitis can do it. Pancreatitis can do it, usually to the loops of bowel next to the pancreas, so under the spleen isn't so likely. So, and also severe enteritis can do it too. So it's not... And it's actually been written up as case series a year and a half ago. There was a case series out of Tufts describing a large number of patients where they observed such a corrugated pattern and what changes were associated with it. None of them are nice things to have, though. They warrant further investigation and concern.
So I like to call it lasagna gut.
Lasagna gut. That's fair enough. That's a nice pathognomonic description. Okay, so there's no this fluid in the abdomen, quite voluminous. Don't expect to see fluid in the abdomen of any great volume, and definitely being echogenic, and in this case swirling, is totally inappropriate. So to make the echogenicity, what sort of things would we think about would do that? Pus, yes, so peritonitis, so cellular exudates. Absolutely, major concern. Now, the most telling image that I've shown you at this point, I believe, is this one up here. This, absolutely, this has the classic appearance of gas reverberative lines. You come to a bright surface here, the peritoneum, and it repeats itself over and over down the picture. And this is reverberation artifact. It's what you see when you put the transducer on the chest when you can't find the heart, when you're trying to find the heart, and you know quickly move away from that area. But to find this ventral to the right kidney is totally inappropriate and of major, major concern. So we immediately pick up the telephone and call the clinician in charge and tell them about this. And we only have one explanation for this. Then has major implications. So, and I'm expecting, if they'll believe me, that this dog should be in surgery within an hour, because to explain this on ultrasound, I am believing there has to be perforation of the GI tract. So sometimes with my younger resident in training colleagues in surgery, they just sort of can't be sure when Dr. Wrigley's really, really trying to get to him and when he's just sort of telling him stuff. So this is what the message was. While we were standing there, we said, well, would you like a sample of that free echogenic fluid? And they usually agree to that with no question. And so we did that, and that then went on to reveal suppurative inflammation in the fluid. But in the meanwhile, while they were still getting that from ClinPath, we did something to, I think, clinch the observation, which had the dog been radiographed beforehand on regular radiographs, I think we probably would have seen already without the need to do the ultrasound. And so here's my other horizontal beam of the evening. Now, in this case, actually this is from my spine lecture, I didn't have one without the ties here, but now we lay the animal on its side. Sometimes you need to leave it on its side with a small volume of gas in the abdomen from a perforation of the GI tract, but only small leakage, for probably 5 minutes at least, up to 10 minutes. And then make a horizontal beam of the cranial aspect of the abdomen under the level of the ribs and the diaphragm of the upside. And so we were really surprised, because we only found that one patch of gas on the ultrasound. This really did surprise me how much of a volume, because this is almost the pelvis back here, a volume of free gas there was in the abdomen. So in my mind, every surgeon has to believe me now. They won't believe the ultrasound, but they have to believe me now, irrespective of the results of ClinPath, which still haven't been done yet, to give us this finding that we have perforated GI tract and we need to be in surgery as fast as possible. Yes? Yes, it is. That is pathognomonic for air. The question you have to always work out in your mind, is it air in the GI tract that's floated up to that point? Or is it air against the peritoneum separate from the GI tract? And I've had some difficulty in really skinny dogs being sure up around the stomach area with a big distended stomach full of gas. But this case, there was very little gas in the stomach. Whether or not this was the gas distended stomach wall touching the peritoneum because the dog's skinny. But in this case, this was well away from the stomach area, and this reverberative line pattern is pathognomonic for gas, wherever it is. And it's what you'll see in the lungs as well. So, that dog was in surgery within an hour. And much as we expected, they found perforated GI tract. In fact, it was the stomach. So those observations of the distribution of the gas pattern in the stomach and the thickened wall of the stomach was actually really important, because the fact it was perforated from ulceration. There was food contamination, unfortunately, in the stomach, from the stomach into the peritoneum. And the owners at that point, who were contacted after being advised on this untoward deterioration in Wolf's situation within 24 hours of arriving with us, decided not to proceed further. And necropsy then confirmed the pyothorax, as well as severe gastric ulceration and free peritoneal gas from the perforation and peritonitis. And the only thing we could find in the history, in addition to obviously the dog being stressed and unwell from the pyothorax, was the fact that in addition to the antibiotics, Rimadyl had also been prescribed and given to relieve some of the pain on the original workup, and came with Rimadyl when he came to us. And maybe that was the final straw with the gastric perforation ulcer scenario. No, there wasn't any penetrating wounds or whatever, and they didn't make any mention about any significant lung changes as part of it. So it was one of these dogs that presented to us. We confirmed what the referring veterinarian do, but within 24 hours took a nosedive really badly in a totally different direction that we worked up really quickly, but unfortunately it was too late. But they said there was extensive gastric ulceration on necropsy. They didn't measure. They didn't define the size of the ulcer perforation. But reading the report indicated extensive ulceration and loss of mucosal surface. Mm-hmm. Brent. Yeah. When I went back to the medicine clinician and asked about that, he said, "Oh yes, Rimadyl and gastric ulceration in an animal that's already stressed and sick is a real big issue and no to do." So the input I got was, "This is not something clinically that one should be using to relieve pain in a quite ill dog situation." Yep, well, why don't you have somebody different?
Okay, so... so the first case I'm going to present to you guys was Bogey, his namesake, who was a 12-year-old neutered male mixed breed, and for the last 2 weeks before presenting, he had been lame. He'd lost some weight, was inappetent. He did have a fever, and they had tried Rimadyl, but he had no real response to the Rimadyl. He continued to be lame. So when he came into you, you palpate the dog, and you notice that he's got really swollen and painful metacarpals and metatarsals. And on your auscultation of the lungs, you notice a slightly decreased lung sounds in the right cranial thorax. So you'd like some films, right? First, I think he did blood work. He did blood work, and it was pretty boring. So we're going to start with the legs, because his lameness issue was his presenting complaint. And here's what his carpus to distal digits look like in both legs. And before you jump to telling me what it is, because I bet half of you know what it is, I want somebody to describe to me what that periosteal proliferative reaction looks like. Palisading, yep, along the diaphyses of our metacarpals in this case. Okay, we even have a little bit down here on a more distal phalanges. And when we have this kind of palisading periosteal reaction in our metacarpals and metatarsals, or other long bones, we think. But the name of the disease we're jumping from. Okay, so that dates Willie over there because it's no longer has a long name like that. It's called hypertrophic osteopathy, right? They drop the pulmonary because although it is vast majority of the time due to pulmonary lesions, it doesn't have to be. And they dropped the arthropathy because you can see it has nothing to do with the joints and it was a stupid part of the name in the beginning. So it's just hypertrophic osteopathy. Can they what, were you asking? Somebody asked something over here. Yeah, there can definitely be other causes besides pulmonary lesions. All right, so hypertrophic osteopathy. We see these firm non-edematous, or in this case they were swollen. So firm swellings of all four limbs. You can see it up higher on the limbs as well, but the most typical place to see is in the distal extremities. It's that palisading periosteal new bone formation. And what causes it is a neural reflex originating in, we've already said, mostly the lungs. And what it does is it causes increased blood flow to those limbs and it promotes this new periosteal bone formation. So the causes, 98% of them are due to thoracic disease, the most common of which would be thoracic neoplasia. But you can have other thoracic diseases that can do it, pneumonias, heartworm, endocarditis. And then we've got 2% of the cases that are actually caused by other issues. Sorry, other things. I've seen bladder cancer. So bladder carcinomas do it, mammary carcinomas. So there can be other causes. But most likely to be the chest, so that's where we're going to go next. So it's sort of a blurry film. Sorry, somebody gave me the digital image without the original, so I couldn't do much with it. But we can see what we need to see, which is... stuff. Yeah, so we got a little pleural effusion. We've got some kind of what? Would you like another view? Again, not the best, but we can see what we need to see. No? We've got some increased opacity here in our right cranial lung lobe area, which we could also see. Could also see here, okay? So we've got some kind of lesion in our right cranial lung lobe, which is a cranioventral lung lobe. So with a little bit of effusion, so our most likely differential is neoplasia, okay? We also might have on our list of differentials some kind of pneumonia. Okay, so what are our choices at this point? Who's he what? We could aspirate it. We could go ultrasound and aspirate because it was in contact with the lung surface, so we definitely could see it. So if you can see it, you can poke it. My motto. If you can't see it and it's in the lung, I would not recommend poking it blindly. I've had some pretty scary situations where I've attempted to do that. I know other people do it routinely, but what else? You could do a BAL, but so in order to do that, you're going to do what? Bronchoscopy. CT. That would be my other choice. Okay, so ultrasound with aspirate, bronchoscopy, and CT. In this particular case, all you get is bronchoscopy. So there they are heading down the trachea. And when they got to that bronchus, to the right cranial lung lobe, there was this lovely greenish, disgusting looking mass sticking out of it, which you of course can biopsy. So they biopsied it. It was a bronchogenic carcinoma. What are you going to recommend to these people? They love bogey. They'll do anything for them. How much money they got? All the money under the sun. They don't care what it costs. Save my dog, please. That's right. We're going to go to surgery. And they completely removed that whole right cranial lung lobe. They took samples of those lymph nodes because that's really going to determine the prognosis, is whether there's mets to those lymph nodes or not. And in Bogey's case, they were clean. So his prognosis is excellent. And his HO went away. And he's now doing really well. Okay, my second case is Skip. And this is truly Skip. As opposed to some cute little puppy. And Skip was a 12-week-old Labrador, and he came in because he was a lot smaller than his litter mates, and his owner was noticing that he was having some exercise intolerance. In fact, she had taken to pushing him around in a stroller already. So you do your physical exam on Skip, and he's quiet, but he's certainly not, you know, your typical bouncy puppy. Otherwise, he seems okay, and then when you auscult his chest, you hear a 4 out of 6 systolic murmur, and you can pretty much hear it everywhere, but if you had to guess, you'd say it's loudest over the right heart base. So, unfortunately, the person wrote on these films, and not only did he write on them, but he wrote the wrong things in the wrong places. So, pay no attention to the writing on this film. But it's still a good film. So, he was attempting to do the Vertebral Heart Score, which, if you guys were in the talk this morning, you do by going carina to apex, perpendicular to that at the widest part. Then you're going to start at T4, count backwards for each of those, see how many vertebral bodies are going to fit in them, and 10.5 would be our high normal, and he was close at his 11.75. So our heart's a little bit big. And if we do, if you'll remember from this morning, if you were there, the two-fifths, three-fifths rule, if you draw this line from the carina to the apex, you should have two-fifths of the heart on the left and three-fifths of the heart on the right. Does it look like it's distributed that way? Yes, no? No. We got a little bit more on the right. So from this, we could say we probably have a little, not only is the heart overall big, but the right side's a little bigger than it should be. I think this is probably the best one for looking at the pulmonary circulation. The two-fifths, three-fifths? Okay, line from the carina to the apex. Two-fifths of the heart should be on the left, and three-fifths should live on the right. And it's really useful. In this case, you can look at the heart and say, well, the heart's big overall, but there's a lot of cases, like when we talked about pulmonary hypertension this morning, where the heart overall may not necessarily be big, but the right side is definitely bigger than it should be. So that's a good rule for trying to decide if you have right-sided enlargement. So what do you guys think about the pulmonary circulation? Can you see these vessels very well? That's the easy one. Yes, no? No. Okay, so we don't see our vessels here very well at all. We have a little tiny caudalobar vessels. So we've got pulmonary undercirculation. Okay, so big heart, especially right side, pulmonary vessels are small. And other than that, though, the lungs were not particularly interesting. Here's his VD. What lives over here? Right ventricle, right atrium. Okay, so his right side, again, we're seeing it's really big. Can you even see those vessels? Barely. Okay, so we're going to come away from this with the same comment. We've got big right side, pulmonary undercirculation. Do we see any of the normal structures being enlarged up here? Because those are going to be important structures for deciding what kind of congenital cardiac disease this dog has. So what's at number one at 1 o'clock? Aorta, can you see it bulging? No. What's at number two? Main pulmonary artery, can you see it bulging? No. Okay, that's also important. And then number three is left atrium. So right heart's large, especially the right atrium. MPA and aorta are unremarkable, and the lungs are unremarkable. So let's talk about congenital cardiac diseases with right-sided murmurs. All right, we're going to go through them one at a time and try and decide if they fit for us. First one we all think of is a PDA. All right? What about that murmur that you heard? Does that fit with the PDA? No. It was systolic, remember? If you have a PDA, you should have the machinery murmur, you know, both during systole and diastole. So the murmur was not continuous. How about the heart? If I have a PDA, so I've got a connection between my aorta and my main pulmonary artery, what's going to happen to my aorta and my main pulmonary artery? They're going to get bigger. We're going to have bulges, right? You're going to have a bulge in the aorta at the level of where the ductus comes out, and you're going to have a bulge in the main pulmonary artery. We didn't have either of those. And how about that pulmonary circulation when you have a PDA? It should be over, right? You're going left to right. You're dumping all that extra blood in that pulmonary artery, which is going to cause over-circulation. And with reverse PDA, it's going right to left. So you're not going to hear it loudest on the right A, and a lot of times you don't even hear them very well. So murmur, like it didn't fit for where we were listening to our murmur. Okay. So our pulmonary circulation is small. It's not over-circulated. So PDA really doesn't fit in any way, shape, or form. How about a VSD? Yeah, the murmur fit, right? We heard it loudest on the right. How about the heart? Yeah, it could work. You know, going left to right, our right side's a little bit big. But the atrium was pretty big, and usually those affect the ventricle more than the atrium, but I'm still not writing it off. Pulmonary circulation. Should be over, yeah, right? Because we're dumping, again, we're dumping left to right, nothing's in the way, it's all going out into the lungs. So that part doesn't fit too well because we had pulmonary undercirculation, not over-circulation. So VSD is going lower down on our list. How about pulmonic stenosis? Murmur fits, right? Totally heard loudest over the right side. How about the heart? What's missing, though? What should I see if I have pulmonic stenosis that we didn't have on that film? Yeah, we've got that post-stenotic bulge on our main pulmonary artery, and we didn't see that. Okay? And again, our left atrium, I mean, our right atrium's pretty big, and usually we're more likely to get changes in the right ventricle, hypertrophy in the right ventricle. Pulmonary circulation? It fits, right? Under circulation. So that works. Okay, so pulmonic stenosis is a little closer, but you know, with a dog that is that clinical for his disease, we really should have seen changes in the main pulmonary artery. Tetralogy of flow. Remember that lovely one? We got the VSD, we got right ventricular hypertrophy, we got overriding aorta, and we've got pulmonic stenosis. So we got that pulmonic stenosis in the VSD. Okay, so for the same reasons that pulmonic stenosis and VSD wasn't great, we can say that tetralogy doesn't really work. The murmur works okay, right? Pulmonic stenosis and the VSD we're going to hear on the right. Okay, the heart doesn't fit because we don't have a big MPA. Pulmonary circulation, you probably wind up with something that amounts to normal or subnormal because you're dumping left to right via your VSD, but you've still got that pulmonic stenosis that's going to restrict outflow into the lungs. Tricuspid dysplasia. And you guys should all be going, oh yeah, Labrador, tricuspid dysplasia. That's a good one. Murmur? Fits, right? Who's on the right? Heart? Yeah? A couple heads shaking. Absolutely. Okay, especially the big right atrium. Totally fits, under circulating because it's all going backwards instead of forward. Okay? So that's looking like our most likely based on the films. And it certainly fits given the breed. So we're feeling pretty comfortable here, but because I was a resident brought up in the day when you jumped to ultrasound, that's where we're going. So you do an echocardiogram. Left atrium, left ventricle, right atrium. Note, here's the mitral valve, which is normal. Look at where the tricuspid valve is coming off the septum. Way down here. Tiny little tethered leaflet here. Pretty stiff other one. Okay? So we can tell our tricuspid valve is not normal. And it comes off of the septum lower than where it should. So we've got ventriculization of the atrium or ventral displacement of the valve. There's another view just from the other side. Okay, my mitral valve's coming off way up here. The atrium's not in the picture. He's got another heart in his heart down here. And here's his tricuspid valve. Look how much lower that's coming off than the mitral valve. Okay, so that's part of what's contributing to how big the left or the right atrium is, because the tricuspid valve is displaced towards the apex of the heart. So your next big question is, it's abnormal, it's coming off in an abnormal place, how much does it leak? Pretty significant leak there going on. Okay, so we've got tricuspid valve dysplasia. Included in that dysplasia is displacement of the valve towards the apex of the heart, and we've got a pretty good tricuspid leak. And in his case, it actually was of elevated velocity, so he had a little pulmonary hypertension as well. So that form of tricuspid valve dysplasia where the valve is displaced towards the apex of the heart is called Epstein's anomaly. So he's got tricuspid valve dysplasia with Epstein's anomaly. His displacement of that valve was probably moderate. Okay, I've seen worse. I've seen cases where there's almost no ventricle there. It's so far displaced. And he had severe tricuspid regurgitation, and the fact that it was a slightly elevated velocity tells us that we've got elevated pulmonary pressures. His prognosis, or the prognosis for Epstein's anomaly, depends on the severity of that apical displacement, the severity of that tricuspid regurgitation, and the severity of the pulmonary hypertension. The worse each one of those are, they synergistically play off the others and create problems. So the case for poor little Skip, or the prognosis for poor little Skip was poor, he had, because of you know, the severity of his changes and the fact that he already is having clinical signs. So fortunately, he was adopted by a technician who knew it was going to be bad news, and she'll give him a good life until he goes into right heart failure. Questions? If you have money, you could go up to CSU and for $10,000 they'll replace his tricuspid valve, and then you can fix him.
Yes.
If you just go down to your home DVD down there, it'll start up where you were. The one that was something else. Yes.
Yes, we had some good success in this tricuspid valve.
And if you don't have any money, like the technician, she's going to wait till he shows signs of right heart failure, and then he'll go on Lasix for as long as he lasts. And for his pulmonary hypertension, if that got bad enough, right now it wasn't really that severe, you could treat him with Viagra. He's under circulating, but he's got increased pressures in those pulmonary vessels, which doesn't mean they're going to be big. Right, he could have, in his case, he was so young it was congenital. So let's say he had pulmonary fibrosis congenitally that was restricting the ability of those vessels to distend, then they're going to look small.
Absolutely, whatever you'd like to do. One comment about pulmonary hypertension. I'd never heard of this syndrome coming from sea level in Australia until I came to Colorado. Remember, we're at 5,000-6,000 feet routinely, and if you're born at that level, there's a much higher, greater incidence of reversal PDAs. I've never seen a reverse PDA until I came to Colorado. And so the dog living here at least 5,000-6,000 feet, Mile High City, if not in higher in the mountains, many dogs we deal with respiratory signs and also cardiac signs have pulmonary hypertension here. Do you want to stretch your legs a moment while they do whatever they need to do? Hit the restrooms, which are close for males, not so close for females. Yeah, remember your face. Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully I've been of some utility. Ten-year-old large dog, non-productive cough for some months, worse in the morning, tires after exercise, physical exam, temperature 105, increased respiratory effort, no heart murmurs, but abnormal quietness to the ventral lung fields, and hematology showed a leukocytosis and band numbers. I'm sorry, yes, let me just step back if you like. So the important thing was the pyrexia, the ventral dullness to the auscultation, the absence of a heart murmur, and an infectious pattern on the hemogram. So I think you all should have that diagnosis by now, right? An asymmetrical ventral distribution to the lung densities that we're seeing principally in the middle right lung lobe here, a lesser degree in the right cranial lung lobe, and some real nice take-home air bronchograms. With the case workup and the hemogram and the cough, pneumonia. Good one. Not meant to be a trick case at all. Straightforward case of pneumonia. And classic radiographic signs of pneumonia. Yes? Yes? Well, this one looks like it's partially aerated line. So I see some patchy irregular densities around it with some aeration through this. So I wonder if this isn't part of an air bronchogram. However, it doesn't quite look right for a regular air bronchogram, does it? No, it's like a sort of a bulge air bronchogram. That's a very good, astute observation. It's very important to the workup of this case. But it's not, I don't think it's a distinct nodule. It's airway associated. Okay, how do we handle the case? Transtracheal wash done at academic center, strep infection, good antibiotic sensitivity, given antibiotics. Over the next month, a good, slow, but gradual response to that. Cough never completely resolved. Kept revisiting us. 3 months later, now the owner felt the dog was normal. So because we had also observed that same change, and it's an older dog, and there was that maybe nodular component, recheck radiographs for the possibility of neoplasia, we thought were indicated, so that's what we persuaded the owner to do. And here's the lateral. It was given for about, I think, about 2 months. I don't know what type. I mean, it was appropriate. And it got a good clinical response. Would you say it got a good radiographic response? Yeah? Yeah, all this consolidate that we were seeing, especially there and to a limited degree here, have resolved. But your very astute observation remains a little bit, doesn't it? See that sort of rounded-looking, well-defined density? There's no nodule anymore of it because I think that was some consolidate around it. There's a little hint of something here, but this could be a blood vessel still at this level. Here's another one at this level, end on. So, this is the issue here. If we start looking at these bronchi, we can see their walls, because this is an elderly dog, and we do normally expect to see on old dog radiographs, which we see many of because of evaluation for neoplasia at CSU, you can normally see faint pencil white lines of the bronchial walls that calcify with age inside the vessels. But do you expect to see a bronchus of this diameter down at this level down here? And the same also in that right middle lung lobe. Look how wide it is. It comes all the way down here. So this term is bronchiectasis. This is the term that's used when you have abnormal dilation of bronchi. And it's actually a structural breakdown of the bronchial wall, allowing abnormal expansion of them. And the more you look, the more you can then recognize these changes through these bronchi right through here. One of our residents has done a study on this, looking at this retrospectively, and provided me with this slide. And this is what is understood to happen in people with bronchiectasis. But first of all, there's excessive mucus production, and you lose cilia, or they're damaged, and the bronchial wall becomes chronically inflamed, and the normal morphology becomes loss in areas with destruction, and then loss of elasticity and permanent distension of the bronchial wall and excessive fibrosis and interstitial reaction around it. And in people, this is most commonly associated with smoking, chronic cough scenario, minors inhaling dust and allergens, so that their bronchi become chronically damaged. in the development of this, then once you have this permanent damage, you get this inability to clear mucus properly because you've lost the cilia apparatus and also they're abnormally dilated. And so it becomes a self-perpetuating cause of infection and pneumonia, bronchopneumonia really, starting at the bronchial level and then progressing into the remainder of the lungs where the bronchi are microscopic and can't be seen well. So here is a recheck. I think it was 8 months later when the dog had started coughing again. And I'm just showing you the ventrodorsal radiograph because now the pneumonia is in both the cranial and caudal left lung lobes. So that was treated also. Dog improved for a while after that. But as happens with these older, both people and animals, you keep getting recurrent bouts of pneumonia because of this underlying bronchiectasis problem. And the dog was 10 when he came to visit us initially, so now it was almost 12 years old, and it died by that time. And necropsy confirmed then what we had seen on the radiographs of these abnormal dilated bronchi with sacculations coming off them, and that's your very astute observation, seeing that really weird air-filled area. And also then at this time of the final infection, pneumonia as well. So if you have, especially middle-aged to older dogs, with recurrent bronchial problems, infections, pneumonias, it's harder when the pneumonia is present because with the air bronchograms, it's hard to appreciate them knowing whether or not they're normal or abnormal size because you really need to see the bronchial walls. Follow them up carefully and look closely at the bronchial walls for both their prominence, thickness, asymmetry between lobes, and size, because it turns out in dogs, in people's saccular bronchiectasis where you get these multiple bulges are more common. In this case, there was that bigger one down in the right cranial lung lobe. But cylindrical bronchiectasis, where the whole major bronchus becomes dilated, is the most common form that the pathologists observe as an underlying cause of recurrent pneumonias. No, not that I know of. If they tore, I would expect the air to escape along them up into create a pneumomediastinum. Same as some traumatized dogs don't develop a pneumothorax, they develop a pneumomediastinum, and I was always taught that was because of rupture of airways close to bronchi, and so the air leaked along the bronchi. So I've never seen that. I think they have, obviously, as that illustration showed, excessive amounts of mucus and inflammatory responses thickening their bronchi. So that probably would seal over any sort of air tendency to leak, I think. Everything becomes abnormally thickened and distorted rather than stretched to the point of breaking. This was prominent, I thought, and the dog certainly would have been in. Well, the dog certainly was in respiratory distress at this point. I mean, obviously breathing heavily in, and this is a nice inspiratory radiograph. You can see how far the diaphragm is back. And megaesophagus, yes, there is a little air in the esophagus right here. And I see esophageal stripe sign here. But I was always taught, and I really don't worry, unless there are clinical signs otherwise, to worry about a small amount of gas in the canine esophagus to the level of the heart base. I see that not infrequently, usually without any clinical signs of regurgitation. And if you make multiple left-right combination radiographs, often it will be on one view and not the other view. So, yes, I agree with you. There is a small amount of gas in the esophagus, but I wouldn't attribute any clinical signs to it. Yeah, the trachea is of quite big diameter, but also if you start now working backwards, see how big the bronchi are coming off the trachea? See the carina there, another one down here? They really stand out well because they're all abnormally distorted and dilated there. Yes? White developed it. Well, in people, I guess the only analogy we can take is that chronic irritants, such as smoking and inhalation of dust and stuff like that, is chronic coughing, which breaks down maybe somewhat the supportive mechanism. The dog was chronically coughing, but by the time you get bronchiectasis it's an infection, you're chronic coughing. So, I don't. Apart from why the bronchi. It could have been, absolutely, yep. The owner certainly didn't rush it to us. I mean, it had this months-long history of chronic coughing. But at that time, as we see it now, there was already bronchiectasis evident on these ready grass. Yes? Another question? Certainly out west here where it's so dry, yes, humidification. The major bronchi is dilated as they possibly can. I don't know about the muscular components of it. It's a matter of, in humans, it's a matter of getting that mucus out as best as you can to stop being a reservoir for infection and long-term antibiotic therapy. Do you want to jump to yours? Terrible microphone.
That's a defective one. Okay, so my next case is Jake. And Jake was an 11-year-old male-neutered Sheltie and presented to the practice with a history of vomiting for 4 days, diarrhea for 2 days, and a loss of appetite for 2 days. When you examine Jake, he seems depressed. He's recumbent. He's got sort of pale pink mucous membranes. You can visibly see icterus. Even I could visibly see icterus. Icteric sclera. His pulses are sort of weak, and he definitely resents abdominal palpation. On your blood work, you have markedly elevated alk-phos, slightly elevated ALT. Your total bilirubin is elevated. You got some elevated white cells there. He is anemic, especially for here. That's pretty anemic. Thrombocytopenic, and you double check that by looking on a slide and counting how many per high power field, so it's real. And he's also hypoalbuminemic. And you'd like to do something having to do with the abdomen, and we have differentials first, sorry. Because we don't jump into these things without thinking. So obviously we had changes in our liver values, so we're worried about hepatic disease. We've seen a lot of lepto here lately, didn't used to. I remember I came from Pennsylvania when I moved out here, and every other liver or kidney case in Pennsylvania was lepto, and I kept saying, it could be lepto, and people go, what are you talking about? And then about 3 years ago, we started to have lepto here. So we think about it. So we could have hepatitis from something infectious like lepto, could be neoplasia. Certainly with our elevated bilirubin, we're thinking potentially biliary disease. Even though our pancreatic enzymes weren't up, still could have pancreatitis. Certainly with our low red cell count and our low platelet count, we could have a little bit of Evans going on there. And he's looking pretty punky. His albumin's low, so we could wonder about DIC as well. So now you get your film. He's sort of a small dog, so they did a dogogram, which I yelled at them for, but that's what we got. Is this a good film to evaluate his lungs? No, it's really expiratory. But we weren't really worried about anything. He wasn't breathing funny. He didn't sound funny when you listened to him. So really, they shouldn't have even gotten his lungs in there, but they did. What was that? Something was big. His liver looks very big. Yeah, here's his fundus. Pylorus is down here. Stomach axis is shifted caudally. You've got this rounded, bulgy thing coming out here. So definitely big liver, potential for mass. He's got loss of detail. So I got loss of detail in fluid. We've got this wispy stuff here, sort of like you sponge painted. You don't see the serosal detail of the small intestine very well. So yes, we're worried about effusion. We're worried about peritonitis. I mean, you could certainly stick it on there, but the blood work pattern really doesn't suggest it. I mean, the vast majority of meningo cases don't have altered blood work, even if they got Mets all over their liver. Sure, and then with the effusion, we can put it on there for you. That works. This one doesn't really help us a whole lot. You can just appreciate, you know, that our liver's big more on the right side over there. So what would you like to do next? Belly tap. That would be the thing that you could do yourself before you have to call me. Unfortunately, this happened in the middle of the night, so it's missing a few important pieces of information. They did not actually tap at the belly. So we already know all that. But they did do an ultrasound. And they found some scuzzy-looking fluid back by the bladder here. And they found this when they looked at the gallbladder. So here's the wall. This is all bile. And you can see it's got these hyperechoic strands running through it. And I can tell you that when they moved the dog and rolled it around and put it in different positions, this pattern never changed. Mucosil would certainly be on our differential list. I have a real problem with that term. And other things can look like this. So we're going to come away from that saying we've got inspissated bile in our gallbladder because it's solid, and no matter how we move the dog, nothing happened. Okay? So biliary mucosil is on our list, but we could have other things. We could have, you know, necrosuppurative cholecystitis. We could have other necrotizing kinds of cholecystitis. It doesn't have to be a mucosil. In fact, I went back and pulled a whole bunch of cases that all had the same ultrasonographic appearance and looked at their surgery reports or their path reports, and those were the three big differentials that came out of them. We did on the, I can tell you on the ultrasound, the liver was a little bit on the mottled side. So hepatitis was on the list of differential. And then we had peritoneal effusion that had a bunch of scuzzy things floating it. So like Dr. Wrigley said, we've got some kind of cellularity to it, so the things we think of with cellularity would be pus or bleeding. Okay, and because our gallbladder looked that ugly, we're certainly worried about the gallbladder having ruptured or the gallbladder oozing, right? Those walls can be so damaged that they don't rupture, but they actually ooze, and you still wind up with peritonitis secondary to it. So the interns were really astute, and they said, we better go to surgery immediately. But they never made it there because the dog died before it ever got onto the table. So they did post it, and there was some dark greenish-black material that was floating free in the abdomen. And there was an omental adhesion to the gallbladder, and when they actually dissected that out, they found a hole in the gallbladder wall underneath it. And the liver was really large and friable. And those were all sent off for histopath. And it was read out as severe necrotizing cholecystitis with fibroplasia. And then severe multifocal acute hepatic necrosis, which the pathologist thought was likely secondary to the cholecystitis. And this... Yes. We sort of obtained more, you know, down and out, but he definitely was very painful when you palpated his abdomen. And he was a Sheltie, and this is gallbladder disease in Shelties is way more common than any other breed in my experience. And I actually think, and I don't know what you think about this, that when I was a resident, we were basically told, they can have all kinds of crap in their gallbladder, and no big deal if it's a dog. And I don't necessarily believe that that's true anymore, and I think that gallbladder disease in dogs has become way more of an entity than it ever used to be. So if I see lots of stuff in a gallbladder, Even if it's moving, I warn people they better encourage bile flow. And if it stops moving, then it becomes a surgical case.
Anyone read the paper by Besso and Wrigley on description of gallbladder mucocele in the canine? Because we wrote it up as the first case descriptions. And there's another paper coming out in JAVMA very soon on another review of about 30 dogs and their clinical signs, blood workup and the like of surgical confirmed mucoceles. And dogs with mild mucoceles where the gallbladder is not really massively distended are perfectly normal, and you'll find them as incidental observations on ultrasound. When they get bigger and bigger and bigger, as long as they're uninfected, often they also don't have any clinical signs except for ones that leak their mucus down into their common bile duct and then obstruct from the fact of the mucus that can't be passed. And then there's another group that somewhere along the line get infected and get necrosis of their gallbladder wall and rupture. And apart from when you find the mucus in the abdomen or effusion in the abdomen, I've never been able to see the rupture in the gallbladder wall. The wall is super thin, though. It's really, really thin, so the classic things of cholecystitis, just like unibladder cystitis, where we get a thickened wall, has gone because it's so overstretched before it ruptured with the infection. And I like to stand them up and lay them on their back for 10 minutes, and if that strandy-like material remains totally unmovable, then that's then how I diagnose a mucocele. And just like Dr. Wirth, I've seen numerous ones of these crash before your eyes from the infection and the peritonitis when it leaks. But I strongly recommend that the gallbladder come out whenever I see anything that supports a mucocele, even though the dog may be perfectly normal, because it's just like getting rid of a ticking time bomb. And this is the best time to do it when the animal's healthy. And if the owners aren't willing to do that, then I recommend Actigel and recheck monthly to see what happens. And sometimes those have seemed to gradually dissipate. Yes? It's believed to be absence of correct flow and both outflow and inflow of bile, and the wall of the gallbladder secretes mucus, and over time it becomes completely filled with mucus, and those cells just keep on secreting mucus. Not believe so in people. It causes upper right abdominal pain is about the only clinical symptomology, unless because it's a nidus then for infection. It's green jello is a really good description of what you see there. It's horrible. Then they become infected just because secondary bacteria pass through and there isn't a normal flushing mechanism to get out there. Sorry? Size related? Diet related, not that I can know about and not that we could find. Yes, you observe it in all different types of breeds. No, I've never seen never seen a ruptured mucocele, and I've never been told about one in a cat. Have you?
I've seen cholecystitis.
Yes, of course.
It's
described in people, but in my recollection of our literature research, we didn't find it in any other species that had been described. Great. You can't aspirate the jello in these guys. It is solid stuff. The first time, just a little story historically with this, I was at a cocktail party in Europe with radiologists, and I was talking to Dr. Besso, who trained at Tufts, and she said, I saw the most extraordinary thing last month. I was ultrasounding this animal, dog, and there was this thing like a wagon wheel sitting in the middle of the abdomen, like spokes of a wagon. And there was peritonitis and effusion. And I said, oh yes, I've seen those in gallbladders. I've never known what they are. She said, oh, well, we opened it up and the gallbladder had ruptured, and this thing they told me was inspissated bile, sludge, mucus. And I went and looked up in people, and they have exactly the same mucosal formation in people's gallbladders. I said, well, I've seen it, numerous cases of those over the years, and I've never known what they are. And everyone, when it was published, and lots of people came up to me and said, I've never known what those things are either. So the importance is that the wall actually will fill you when they're very distended, because it's really thin. It's pushed way out because it's really over distended. We actually measure gallbladder volumes and have tables for gallbladder volumes in dogs, and they've been published, but we use that. And ultrasound machines, in doing a volume measurement, I've discovered a very accurate at determining gallbladder volume. The formula that's in there for urinary bladder will work great on the gallbladder, and you'll be within 10%, because I've actually done some necropsy. And these guys, rather than cholecystitis, which, just like the urinary bladder, has a thick wall, these have a paper-thin wall as they get more and more distended, till it finally just then ruptures. And they're usually chronic ruptures, because all the ones that ruptured we had adhesions visible at necropsy. So this, again, wasn't an acute issue. They were a chronic. Yeah? Yes, if they survive 48 hours, our surgeons would say, in critical care. These are usually nasty infections, often gram-negative and release toxins, and so just the surgical manipulation plus the stress of surgery can just tip them right over that toxic effect. So you want to pre-treat with gram-negative antibiotics IV and support them as much as you can to try and stop them going into DIC. And so they are, when they present like this case did, they're per-acute emergencies with a very poor prognosis of making it.
All the ones I've seen that already had evidence of peritonitis from rupture or mucus died before or post-surgery.
Yep, that would be quite common. Sure. No, not commonly, fortunately, but I think you're probably looking at a mucosal rupture, because that's how it is. It's like jello. I mean, and you can sort of stick into it and then pick the whole thing up, and if it had spread apart like that, that's how it will stay together. It's not yellow bile. It's not the standard yellow greenish bile. Go ahead, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. No, not as a rupture from trauma. They just have bile stain, peritoneal effusion, and it's runny and liquid. It's just a really acidic type fluid by the time it's ruptured. And I've been surprised how difficult it is on ultrasound to find those traumatic ruptures, and missed many of them. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, the fluid or really hyperechoic surrounding area.
Yep, a halo.
Around the gallbladder, those are the things that really tip me off that, you know, there's something more than just what's going on in the gallbladder that somehow spreads against that.
So traumatic rupture, yes, certainly seeing fluid around the gallbladder in its fossa. But to actually see the rupture, I'm not been very good at that. And actually, in reading numerous cases, I've been surprised how the gallbladder was intact, but actually the main bile duct had ruptured from trauma, which again, can't have any hope of seeing. So there's our tangents of gallbladder. Yeah, if you like, sure.
So Brandy was an 11-year-old female, Brittany Spaniel, and she presented for difficulty breathing, and it had increased over the past couple of weeks. She was not coughing at any point in her history. She had severe orthopnea. Her head and her neck were extended. severe respiratory distress. Dr. McKiernan said he had a video and then he couldn't find it, but he described the dog as doing this. He's having a horrible time breathing. You can hear some crackles caudodorsally. It had no tracheal sensitivity and no upper respiratory stridor. Pale, muddy, cyanotic mucous membranes. And then you also, because you're very thorough, palpate a large, thick, flat, round mass in the region of the third mammary gland. And so you pray out the patient's film. If you only get one, because the dog's having a really hard time breathing, then this is what you get. The other one you might think of is lympho,
I've been surprised over the years because we have such an active oncology group at CSU with lympho on the follow-up chest radiographs, how much the interstitial pattern goes away after chemo. And so many lympho dogs, interstitial patterns due to lymphoid location of their metastasis. So let's quickly step through here. Now I've got a couple of quickies here that have the common symptomology of abnormalities on their CBCs. 6-year-old dog, a lick lesion, otherwise normal, no heart murmurs, but the CBC showed xenophilia and basophilia. Fecals didn't reveal anything. One radiograph, second radiograph. I think this should be a no-brainer, right? We go back. If you're from Florida, I'm heard. It is a hard-brainer for our students because this is not commonly seen here in Colorado. It is, however, becoming endemic in the west part of the state, in Grand Rapids, and then Grand Junction on the Colorado River. But what we see is increased interstitial pattern in the lungs, follow then blood vessels to see disproportionate enlargement of this one compared to its adjacent one with the bronchi in between and some bronchial prominence and thickening. Which one lies above the bronchi? Artery. All right, comes down, truncates down, quickly tapers, disappears. Similar, another curving artery up in here, another weird density here, and see our main stem bronchi down here. The big vessels are on the lateral side here, and following the heart up here, nice big bulge here. At 2 o'clock, here's the aortic area, normal, 1 o'clock. So we can diagnose this as chronic heartworm disease. Good work. If you gave this to my students, they'd probably tell me it's a cancer case. Okay, so quite simple, Notch test, antigen test, both positive. That was the explanation of the blood parameters. Now you want to be really cautious, don't you, in treating this? I would, because I've seen numerous ones of these when these have these sorts of radiographic chronic changes not make it through therapy. Because what we're seeing on the radiographs are severe reaction to the heartworms, probably a lot of it allergic, reactive tissue nature. We've got to kill those worms. The vessels are already tortuous and hypertensive. That's why we're getting the secondary dilative effects to the main pulmonary artery. So this is really good, but you read this and the dog made it. But I don't know what your experience has been with this, even with when I started practice, it was carpastolate injections. Now this is thought to be a little less aggressive, a little less instantaneous in killing all the worms. But do you get these dogs through this? All the time. Good work. No. No. Yes, they're titrated in very, very slowly and do everything possible to keep the animal quiet, rested, and anti-inflammatorized. Okay, now not quite so easy. 3 years old, presents then with coughing, and it's been going on for some month ago and worsening. And there are respiratory signs, as you read here, of inspiratory effort with wheezing and crackling. And the CBC showed a very marked peripheral eosinophilia, 7,000. With what I would say would be upper bronchial, upper type airway sounds rather than peripheral alveolar sound. Now remember, this is only a 3-year-old dog, so we don't have any old dog lung bronchial things to rely to say, you know, fall back on and say, oh, it's just an old dog. This is a really nice inspiratory radiograph, right? In fact, this looks like excessive inspiration to have this much this gap between the heart and the diaphragm. So remember, when you breathe really deeply in, the interstitial density in your lungs becomes much less and less apparent. So this diffuse change involving all of the lung lobes visible here, from the hilar area to the periphery, is throughout. So is it due to abnormal blood vessels? Nope. We, I think, can make out some blood vessels. They don't look enlarged. They're harder to see than normal. Then I back off, is it due to alveoli that are full and have air bronchograms? Nope, we don't see any consolidates. We expect them to be ventral, especially because we think of infectious agents and air bronchograms and like. So we've ruled out alveolar infiltrates. So that leaves us only two compartments in the lungs, right? So the two compartments in the lungs are interstitial and bronchial. I've always thought that bronchial and interstitial sort of were pretty much related, because the bronchi that we can see are in the areas that we can see the interstitial stuff. You can't get bronchial disease without thickening them and getting thicker bronchi from the reactive interstitium around them. So the thing that I'm looking for to differentiate between what we were seeing before, where we had a diffuse spread throughout the lungs unrelated preferentially from a bronchial origin last time, and a bronchial origin situation, is something, some donuts, good work. Yes, I asked my students, have you gone to the Dunkin' Donuts store this morning here? Can you see him here? Absolutely! Oh, I like it. Start looking through here. You see all these black holes everywhere? Everywhere, 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 everywhere. Yes. And not only are in the major bronchi, and in most dogs, you'll find a few donuts in the major hilar area, central region of lungs, but these are in the middle and even out to the periphery out here. So I like your call of this is predominantly a bronchial reaction mixed then with its corresponding interstitium there. Okay? So what differential diagnosis are we going to come up with then? Did the owner smoke? So allergic based. Chronic pulmonary obstructive disease. We don't have this at all, the syndrome, and I always say to my students, certainly in more moist areas, are there parasites that live in bronchi? In Sydney, Australia, with this bronchial pattern in the cat and the dog, we'd immediately treat them with ivermectin for lung lung disease. Out here in the desert part, in this so freezing environment until this week when you came to town and brought warm weather with you, they can't survive the winter and they can't survive the summer. So allergic is there. So I didn't... Mycoplasma, I expect some degree of alveolar and lobar localization from even a mycoplasma pneumonia. So there is a syndrome called pulmonary eosinophilia, PIE, pulmonary infiltrative eosinophilia. And in my recollection of reading that paper, the most common underlying cause was heartworm disease. There is no evidence of any heartworm changes, such as on the previous case, to support that. So I don't think we have a clear-cut diagnosis from here. We need some more differentiating tests to do. So what would you think would be useful? Yes. Bronchoscopy, sampling the bronchial airways, transtracheal wash might even do it. So, fecal exam, absolutely. If you're in lungworm country, here it's probably not high on our list, but that's only because of a geographical situation. So yes, we agree with this. Come on forward. So, cytology of the transtracheal wash confirmed the eosinophils coming out in that direction as well. Heartworm test was negative because we said that's the most common cause. We couldn't find any other cause. We couldn't find any evidence of parasitism. And so, at the bottom line, we never found the cause of this. We treated it symptomatically for an allergic-based reaction, as you can read here. And by 1 month of corticosteroid administration, the dog's clinical signs had gone away completely, and this is the recheck radiograph, where, as far as I could observe, I would call it normal. And all the radiographic changes have resolved. So there are some that we never get to understand what is the cause of the xenophilia and the reaction. And certainly we have the possibility of allergic allergens being breathed in that cause the bronchitis. We just don't ever decide upon. But there was also a few cases in that paper that they never established what the diagnosis was either, but they responded symptomatically to therapy. Questions, comments? Yeah. I don't expect that because they're going to be interstitial in their migration. I've never actually observed, in Australia, little puppies would be totally infested by parasites, and I remember some of their radiographs being perfectly normal. I wouldn't expect the donut sign so much, because they're actually migrating through the interstitium there. Yes? Yes, once got over this acute phase and the lungs settled down like this, it never returned to us. So I assume having remained good. Now this is a one-year-old, 5 months from age, has developed episodic coughing, and then it's been worsening to the point almost of seeming to choke to the owner. And again, auscultation was similar to that previous dog, with wheezing and upper airway sounds. In this case, we also had a hacking cough when we palpated the trachea. And the CBC, again, showed xenophilia and basophilia. Because of the reaction to tracheal palpation in the jacket included a radiograph of the entire trachea from the larynx then through the thorax, so there was an extra view in there as well. Then there's our ventrodorsal view. So I've gone back to the lateral. Yeah, look along the dorsal wall here, and then look along the ventral wall. Very good. No wonder he's trying to choke. This one, I mean, this looks like it's half the diameter on the lateral image there. And there's a real close-up for you for maybe the non-believers. Have you ever seen this before? No? No one? Very close. Very good. Yes, so there are some parasitism, granulomatous forming parasites that like upper airways, and the best chance of finding them on the radiograph is in the trachea. And so there are granulomas there, and then it's a matter of deciding what they are. Come on. And here it was. So the bronchoscopy confirmed them, and the fecal examination then found osleri, which Leela informed me used to be called Filaroides osleri. And it, in the history, the puppy actually was from an unknown location. It was bought in a pet shop. So it's not something that is endemic at all to Colorado. Don't go away thinking about, oh, this occurs in Colorado frequently. It, I'm sure, came with it from elsewhere. I don't know its biological half, what intermediary it lives in as an object. But it was easy to treat, and both the blood parameters returned to normal, and the clinical signs went away. So it's you've spent a good 2 hours with us. I hope this has been helpful. You aced a lot of them, so that was good. And maybe you've seen some new things that you hadn't seen before, and some new approaches to trying to solve these imaging questions. And it was useful to you.